Better buy it. Oh, yeah.
It's 9:09.
Sad.
And present for the record are Senators Bundy, Stevens, French, and myself, McGuire. We do have five items on the agenda today that we're going to try to get through here. First up is Senate Bill 198, Campaign Finance Election Code Violation. And we have Senator Wilikowski here to tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm a state senator for Northeast Anchorage. SB 198 is a bill that comes with the is recommendations made by the Alaska Public Offices Commission to restore the statute of limitations to 4 years to investigate and prosecute alleged violations of state campaign finance reforms. While there are a few states with currently Alaska has a single-year statute of limitations, and there are a few states with single-year statute of limitations, most states allow for more time for alleged violations to come to light and then be thoroughly investigated. For example, Georgia allows filing of complaints within 3 years of a violation involving any person elected to serve a term of 2 years and within 5 years for any person elected to serve a term of 4 years. Washington and California allow complaints to be filed within 4 years. Connecticut, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and New Jersey have no time limits. Several states, including Minnesota and Ohio, extend their statutes for fraud, concealment, or misrepresentation. In such cases, the time limit becomes 1 year from the date of discovery, which is different than Alaska. At the unanimous urging of the APOC commissioners, this bill would reinstate the 4 year statute of limitations that existed until 2003. We believe this provides sufficient time for an alleged violation to be discovered and then investigated. The bill also seeks to implement several other recommendations adopted unanimously by the commission. And I'll just briefly go through those. For example, this proposed bill would restrict post-election fundraising to 10 days after an election. The bill also limits the amount of surplus campaign funds that can be given to a political party to $5,000. Which brings this section of the statute in conformity with AS 1503070, which limits individual donations to political parties to $5,000. Also, at the recommendation of the APOC commissioners, this would increase the civil penalty for lobbyists who do not file required reports with the commission from $10 to $50 per day. The penalty has not been increased since 1976, and the commission is concerned that it is not substantial enough to encourage timely filing. And with that, I'll stop right there. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them. Thank you.
Sure. And Senator Wilikowski, why 10 days versus 45 on fundraising? Page 2, line 8. Just wondering how you arrived at the number of days.
Again, this was a recommendation by the APOC commissioners, and it was unanimous.
And what did they base that on?
I think the fundamental idea is after you win your election, you shouldn't be fundraising. And so I think the idea is you fundraise up until your election, and then that's what you have.
Okay. Senator Stevens.
Well, Madam Chair, that's certainly never been a problem in my campaigns. I could tell you that. But is this a problem? I mean, is it an issue? Has anyone abused it? How often? Where? When? Who?
Yeah, if that's something that the committee has an issue with, I'd be willing to take that provision out.
I'm just trying to think through the logic of it. Trying to think of some of the elections I've seen where the underdog wins, not well funded, and does the shoe leather, gets out there, but then wants an opportunity to recover some of the maybe even the personal costs they've put in.
And we have APOC online, and perhaps they can answer some of the detailed questions that you might have.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. And I look at it with a slightly different twist that hasn't occurred to me, but it seems that some of the federal level campaigns, people who lose have fundraisers because they need to recruit personal funds they've gone in put into the campaign, and I'd be really interested in hearing. I can understand the 10 days if that just covers donations that might be in the mail, but if you actually wanted to do some fundraising, I mean, I understand if you've won, maybe you're leaning on people a little bit doing fundraising, but if you've lost, you're certainly not providing any undue influence that anybody that would be generous enough to come and help you cure a campaign debt.
Okay, and we do have Chris Ellingson. Chris, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Why don't would you mind sharing with us the rationale or the thought process behind the 10-day recommendation, page 2, line 8?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Ellingson, and I'm the acting executive director for APOC. Madam Chair, the rationale behind that was based on the actual fact that what has been happening since campaign finance reform is the, like you said, the winners usually are the ones that get the money before and after the campaigns, and there seems to be a lot of like Senator Bundy said, a run of fundraisers. Some of it is to recoup some personal money, some of it is to pay off debts that have been incurred, but quite a bit of it has been used to get the money and then turn around and give it away in different arenas. So the commission was looking at some of these instances where the money was going some to charities where in some instances there were fairly close nexuses between the candidate and the people that were on the boards, and also quite a big sum were going to the political parties. The part of it making it 10 days, the commission was thinking if they had 10 days, then I believe there was a place where we were going to request that the 10-day after election report be reinstated, and I don't know if it's in this bill or not, and that the year-end report be moved back to December 31st, which makes more sense. And so that's why they were looking at the 10-day, the 10-day time frame. They were not wedded to it, and if it is a problem, I'm sure that they would understand if it came out.
Okay, thank you so much. Chris, questions? Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, through the chair. Good morning, Senator Bundy.
Actually, we say good morning in this committee through Grayson.
Okay. Hi, Grayson.
A couple of things, I appreciate your explanation. This notion of harvesting money and then turning around and passing it on to parties and charities and that sort of thing, I would understand and support the limitation for that. My question is, the bill also contains a $5,000 maximum contribution. Would that help the concerns that you've expressed? And the other thing is, if it was limited to only people who had lost the election, would that help? Because as you may have heard me say earlier, someone who has won the election and then has a fundraiser may indeed be, people may feel pressured to attend that.
Through the chair, the $5,000, that would really make a big difference, and if that's left in the bill and it goes forward, I'm sure the commission would have no problem with the time period being up to the 45th day. One of the things that's real important for people to remember and to think about is that usually the people that run for election and win are the ones that are able to have the fundraisers. Nobody usually ever goes to the people that don't win's fundraisers after the election. That is, historically has been a thing. I mean, it's sad but true.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This 5,000 figure, is that really a problem? I mean, how often does that happen? I mean, I'm looking at my campaign. If I have a few hundred dollars left over to spread around to charities, I'm lucky. But how often has there been a $5,000, excess of $5,000 given to a political party?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, quite often. And that's because your limits on what you can roll forward to a new campaign are. And I mean, I can't give you hard numbers, but I know that I have seen anywhere from 10 to 15, sometimes 20,000.
You probably did.
And it doesn't necessarily go to the central committee. It goes to different arms of the committees, to the subdivisions.
What I said, Chris, while you're speaking, is that I think we need some facts on this, just to rush forward and say, well, it's happened often. I mean, give us some data, I think. I need some information before I'd agree to this.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I can get that for you and get it to you probably this afternoon, but my best guess would be that in every election campaign, there's between, I would say, five, maybe six candidates that that do donate that much to parties.
Okay.
And it is part of the disbursement process after the election is over.
I guess you're looking at people that never had enough money to do that, Senator French.
Just a question. Chris, my question is about political parties, and I think you mentioned subdivisions. Wouldn't the subdivisions be captured by this rule? That is, you wouldn't be able to donate $5,000 to, let's just say, for example, the Republican Party, and then give money to a subdivision of that, say, an election, a candidates fund, or a South Central candidates fund, or a Southeast candidates fund. Wouldn't those all fall under that $5,000 limit?
Through the chair, Senator French, yes, that's correct. What this is doing is that everybody else in the state that wants to contribute to the party can only give $5,000. And so the commission's discussion during this time period is, well, why shouldn't a candidate be the same way? Because the monies that they're bringing in are coming from citizens of the state, and that money has been given to that candidate to be elected. So now he's done with his campaign, and he's you know, dispersing his funds. Why should they get to give more to the party than any individual?
But for clarification, the $5,000 limit, if we adopted this rule, would be a total overall limit.
That's right.
You couldn't do an end run around that rule by breaking it into $5,000 chunks to different subdivisions.
No, it's the same. That's what I'm saying. When it brings it into line with every other person that contributes, that's the max. If somebody contributes $5,000 to the central party, they're done for the year. If an individual contributes $5,000 to one of the subdivisions, they're finished. They can't give any more for the year.
That's what I was after. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Further questions of Chris?
Okay. Sure,
Senator Stevens.
I assume, Chris, this is something that you feel is abusive in both parties?
Absolutely.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you for your time, Chris.
Thank you. I'll be here for questions if anything else is needed.
Okay. I appreciate that. Let's see here.
I do have.
Oh, yes. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. The raising the lobbyist fine from $10 to $50 a day, I see where it hasn't been raised in a number of years, and probably just from inflation should be raised. But just out of curiosity, I'm wondering how often do you, as a general rule, have to impose a lobbyist fine, and how many days are they usually in arrears?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. Funny you should ask. We have usually at every commission meeting between 5 to 15 lobbyists up for civil penalties review because they want to appeal them. And we have had from time to time some lobbyists that have paid some pretty hefty fines. When I say hefty, I'm talking $5,000, $7,000, and that's at $10 a day.
Wow. If I might, while they're up for appeal, they're not being assessed the penalty, are they? Or this is after everything's been adjudicated and they still haven't filed?
through the chair, they have to file, a lobbyist has to file their reports, and they're assessed the penalty. The clock stops on the date the report is filed, and then the appeal, they can appeal it once they get the letter with the penalty amount.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Stevens.
So I think what you're saying is that we're in the past you've had $7,000 fines at $10 a day. We could be talking about, at $50 a day, $35,000 fines, right?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Get in line. File your stuff, huh? Okay, any further questions for Chris? All right, it looks like Alpheus Bullard, Legal Services. Is that just for questions?
Yes.
Okay, so any questions for Legal Services? Okay, Brenda Page, Department of Law.
This is Brenda Page, Madam Chair. I'm also available for questions.
Okay, Steve Cleary. Steve, are you there?
No.
Not on. Okay, anyone else here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 198? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, that brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. Committee discussion. Senator Stevens.
No, I haven't formulated any thoughts on it. I'm not a great friend of lobbyists, but it does seem like $35,000 fine is a little hefty, but they earn lots of money, so maybe so. I don't know. I guess I have some problems with the issue of the 10 days and with the $5,000. I'm not. I guess I need to know why it's so bad that. That parties receive funds and they disperse them to the candidates. I mean, what is so bad about the system we have right now where somebody can give five service campaign funds? I guess I just need to have more information from APOC on why they're making these changes.
Okay, Senator Wilkowski, did you want to respond?
I'd be happy to get you any information that you need, Madam Chair or Senator Stevens. I guess from our perspective, we heard from Chris Ellingson. I thought it was compelling testimony. APOC has unanimously decided this is something that's important to them. And I guess on the $10 fine, if a lobbyist right now is getting fined $7,000, then that's if my math is right, that's almost about two years that they haven't filed a report. I suspect.
Are lobbyists not filing reports?
That's what the testimony was. And that she said they have 5 to 15 per APOC meeting. So I think it is a problem.
Yeah.
And I think if you increase the fine, you're probably not going to have people not filing them. Right. I think what's happening right now is the fine is so small that they're just ignoring the fine. They're saying, well, I'll pay the fine rather than have to disclose this information. I think if you increase the fine, you'll have more come into compliance.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
Well, I can certainly understand the logic of saying that a candidate shouldn't donate more than a private individual. The 5,000 limit makes sense to me. I think Chris said that the 10-day or 45-day was not as important to them as the 5,000, if I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think that's what I heard. And I could certainly support the 5,000 limit, not having ever been challenged by that being unlimited before. If I heard correctly, I think they had 10 to 15 that are doing appeals. I don't think there are 10 to 15 that are in arrears in filing their paperwork. It's kind of like IRS. You file it and then meet the deadline and then argue about it afterwards, but I don't understand why they wouldn't file on a timely basis. So not too concerned about the $50 a day. So the 45-day, I still have some trouble understanding why an election winner should be able to do the 45 days. I don't know if we want to get creative and say losers get 45 days and winners get 10.
Do you have any suggestions? I know I don't.
Well, and maybe it is not worth all the time and effort because, as Chris said, not many people go to loser fundraisers. But again, I don't want to discourage anybody from running, and there might be people who say, I'll run and I'll put a substantial amount of my own funds into the campaign with the hopes that I can recoup some of my loss if I don't prevail. Maybe I could ask Chris what she would think about differentiating between winners and losers and the 10-day versus the 45-day.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I think that it would be doable, but it would probably be better to either make it 45 or 10 across the board. And as I said, the commission's not wedded to the 10-day.
Okay, thank you. It does seem like we get unnecessarily complicated doing that. And let's see, the election is November. We got November, December. So we wouldn't be in session within the 45 days.
You know, I have an interesting argument to bring out there just in my own, Chris, just for you guys to think about, but in the committee, but is that what I find in a campaign oftentimes is if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're out door knocking so much, you're taking your time actually campaigning out in your district that raising money becomes a burden. It's literally just a means to an end. It's this burdensome thing that you want to get your message out. You've got to be able to print a few pieces and so forth, buy some TV time. And it just becomes this thing. And what I have noticed is that I will raise some money after that deadline, kind of more compartmentalizing, that that I think about, you know, towards the end, that I just run out of time to try to do all things. But that's just one thought. I don't know how every individual candidate thinks, but I've never been one to raise money to give to a party or anything like that. But anyway, Senator French.
Madam Chair, thanks. From my perspective, at least, the very heart of this proposal is the statute of limitations extension. I think that's the provision that the public wants to see passed. I think it's the real sort of meat of this bill. I can see there's sort of quibbling about the other provisions of the bill, and this being a Senate bill and its first committee referral, still on the Senate side, it's got a long way to go if we're going to fix this problem this year. So I'm just wondering whether the committee would be comfortable at least agreeing that that provision should go forward. And I would recommend today, I think we can all agree that a one-year statute of limitations on campaign violations is insufficient given the meager resources that APOC has, given the enormous number of people that we now require to disclose to APOC. And so at least rally around that central provision of the bill. And, you know, I could probably, you know, we could probably, you know, post-election fundraising. I don't know how huge a problem it is. I don't know if there's any abuses or not. The APOC says there is. Maybe we could just reduce that to 30 days. There should be some limit. I don't think you should be, you know, fundraising, you know, past Christmas. you know, after an election, you should wrap it up and be done with it. But there are frequent, you know, I've seen losing candidates throw fundraisers. You know, some folks spend a lot of money and try to gain a seat. They narrowly lose. Some folks may be trying to encourage them to come back and try it again. Yeah. And winners sometimes wind up, you know, I've had to come deeply out of pocket to get through an election cycle.
Yeah.
And so you try to get some of that back. So I wonder whether we couldn't, whether the committee wouldn't feel comfortable, say, amending that to 30 days and then keeping the four-year statute of limitations and moving those two portions of the bill on forward to the next committee, which then goes to finance, and at least we can say we've made a chop at the problem.
Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, just to point out, we have another bill in here that addresses only the four-year statute of limitations. We could set this one aside and use the other bill as a vehicle, and that would be a very clean way to do it.
And
I'm not sure this bill sponsor would be excited about that.
being Switzerland today, I think what I'd like to do is
99.
Yes, is one, and is to advance them both and let them move through the process. I 30 days seems to me like a compromise. I don't know what the committee would think about that. Is that, do you want to make that
the
form of an amendment?
I'll move that on page 2, line 8, that the number 10 be replaced with the number 30. And that's my proposed amendment number 1.
Okay. Is there an objection to that? Seems reasonable to me. And then let's keep hearing, Chris, maybe we hear again next year how that plays out. And maybe with the limitations on the party amount, that takes care of the problem. Okay, so amendment number 1 carries. Further amendments to Senate Bill 198?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Not an amendment, but somehow I need to know the principle. I mean, what's the reason? Why are we saying an issue of the $5,000 political party? You know, I know every time I've run, I've gotten some money from the party early on in the campaign. From my Republican Party, I assume Senator French received money from his Democratic Party. And though I've never returned any money to the party, you know, because I've never had that much money left over, but it might be a good idea to refill those coffers with the money they gave me to run. What's so wrong with, in principle, what is so wrong with returning money to a party? What's the principle out there that leads you to present this this piece of the bill?
Good question.
And again, Senator Stevens through the chair, this was something that AIPAC felt should be changed. They unanimously voted in support of it, and it's really just putting that in line with what any other individual in the state can donate. It's $5,000. But I think Senator French really hit on it. The meat of this bill is the statute of limitation. The other things are, I think, things to consider. But if the committee has a real concern over that, then maybe that's something we could take up at another time.
Well, I can appreciate, Madam Chair, APOC's saying that they want to do it, but they have not presented a compelling argument to me that it's a bad thing, that what we're now doing is necessarily so wrong. Not that I've ever been involved in that, but it does seem to me that there's nothing wrong with returning funds to a political party that has supported you. And to return back to the amendment we just agreed to by consensus, why 30 days instead of 45? I mean, what's the rationale there? Is it just a compromise?
I think there should be some limit, and I think, I think 30 days is enough time to wrap up a campaign, raise a little money if you have to, settle your debts, and close it out. But as to this section, I tend to agree with you. I'm not certain that there's been, you know, what abuses there are out there, I don't think are centered on the settling of campaign accounts, and I wouldn't oppose a motion to strike Section 3.
Okay, so amendment number 2 to strike Section 3. Is there an objection?
Yeah, I'd object.
Bundy?
Well, okay. We have a package of recommendations from AIPAC, and you know, in our wisdom, we're dissecting those and picking and choosing among them. I think, as I said, if you want a clean bill, we've got one.
Okay, I'm going to oppose the amendment only because I can see where my philosophical argument would be, and I could see where you start getting into a situation where you're utilizing candidates who are propped up by the party to then regenerate funds for the party and sort of go outside the construct of the regular method by which we raise money for the party. And so that's just a thought to think about. And so maybe the cleaner way is to stick with the law the way we have it. Senator French?
Just as a point of order, I said I wouldn't oppose a motion.
Okay.
I wouldn't oppose a motion. I was signaling
to Senator
Stevens.
We're just talking out loud.
Where my mind was going if you were so inclined. But that's what I was doing.
Well, and maybe what could happen, Senator Stevens, because I think you make good points, is that between now and the next committee, if there could be some more information given to Senator Stevens about that. That's just my, I'm waxing philosophic about why I think that that provision is a good one to reduce it to 5,000. I don't know what the individual thoughts were behind APOC, and so perhaps you could get that. So there is no amendment number two. And so we have Senate Bill 198 before us as amended to 30 days. Is there a motion? Senator French.
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate Bill 198 be passed out of this committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
And I'll object.
Okay, there's an objection. Senator Bundy, speaking to
yes,
objection.
Well, Madam Chair, I know you said we have two bills that have the core, the extension, and this one is a more complicated bill, and I don't see in, I mean, you're the committee chair, you certainly have the prerogative to move whatever bills you wish, but I don't see the sense of moving this out of committee when there's lots of questions yet. When we have a clean bill, we could simply move on and get to the core of the matter that a number of people have said is really the most important aspect. So I think we should work on this bill, and I think these $5,000 questions are important ones, and then let the clean bill move forward, and we can let this one catch up after we get our questions answered.
Okay, and my rationale is I just don't want politics to get in the way of what seems to be a good idea that people have been putting forward, good enough that, you know, you've got two members out of 20 that have put it forward. And my thought is I don't want to let politics get in the way of that dialogue. And so if I can put them both forward and see which of those vehicles makes it forward, then that's great. So that's my thinking on the matter. So if you do you want to maintain your objection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, somewhere down the line, someone's going to have to make those decisions. We might as well make them here.
Right. Okay. And Madam Secretary, could you call the roll?
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Chair McGuire?
Yes. Okay, and so brief at ease. So does that mean it does not move? We have the matter of Senate Bill 199, which is a similar version of the bill we just heard by Senator Jean Tirio. And this bill simply addresses the 4-year statute of limitations, but I'll let the senator tell us about that. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you mentioned, first of all, Senator Jean Tirio, Senate District F, Senate Bill 199 does just address the one issue of the statute of limitations, takes it from the current statutory language of 1 year to 4 years. Section 2 of the bill, the applicability, just makes it clear that it will apply, the new 4 years will apply to any matter that has taken place within 1 year look back. And then prospective, so it's not going to apply retroactively and now start reaching back 4 years. It's just that issue. That change was contained in a bill 4 or 5 years ago that passed. That bill, when it was first introduced by the administration then, was to abolish APOC. And then after getting quite a bit of pushback on that, they made a number of changes. This change to 1 year that took place then, in looking back in the record, my staff, listening to the debate on the floor, there wasn't a lot of debate on that topic. There were other portions of the bill that generated a lot of sound and fury, but this particular portion did not. I also do not remember back at that time whether there was any objection from APOC and making that change, and I'm not sure why. Again, they may have been focused on other portions of the bill or more focused on the initial bill, which would have abolished the agency. You can see by the fiscal notes now the you know, if that change is made, there's a not insignificant fiscal note funding request that is made by Department of Law and by the APOC division itself.
Can we take a brief at ease here for a second, a brief pause? Senator Green.
Thank you.
Back in order.
So what may have been part of the debate at the time was APOC was struggling with their budget, too, and they may have determined that going to the 1 year at that time freed up some of the pressure that they had on their budget. But for whatever reason, the change was made, and now certainly with the dynamics that we've come through for the last year and a half, it certainly seemed prudent to me that we revisit that issue and consider going back to the 1 year. And so this bill does just that. Having sat in the committee and listened to the debate on the previous bill, Madam President or Madam Chairman, I know that you had mentioned the other day that it was your thought that perhaps both bills would move from the committee. Certainly, since this is wholly contained in the other bill with Section 4 of the other bill with similar applicability section, if it was the decision of the committee to move the other bill and hold this one, that would be okay with me. I have a higher bill number. That's been the rule in this body, although an unwritten rule, that the lower bill number moves, and so I would certainly bow to my colleague that has the lower bill number. That's appropriate. I was actually disappointed when that rule was violated earlier this week, and being the one that paid the price in that, for now me to be disappointed when the rule is violated, I have to say that the rule should be followed if there is a lower number. Now, certainly also from the previous debate, there are other components in that other bill that are problematic to some of the members, and I understand some of the concern. On the $5,000 issue, I think perhaps a specific difference is that the limitation on $5,000 of what I as an individual can give to the party, that's me, Gene Terrio. If I have surplus campaign money, that money does not belong to me. That's not my funds. Mm-hmm. At the end of a certain date, in fact, I either roll it forward to a POET account or give it to the state treasury. I have to give it away because that's not my personal money. Mm-hmm. So to say that the two should be treated exactly the same, I'm not sure that logic necessarily carries through. I understand the feeling the press of time ticking away here. If you want to move this bill, and ultimately the other bill with the lower number catches up, and then it ultimately makes it to the floor containing this provision, that's okay with me. That's the way the body has operated over time.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Terrio. Senator Bundy and then Senator Stevens.
Yeah. Question for Chris, who I assume is still with us. Chris, this addresses the statute of limitations. That was the number one concern of APOC. Do you feel 199 addresses your concerns adequately as far as the statute of limitations?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, the commission was open to 4 or 5 years, and we would be delighted with 4. Okay. That puts it back to what it was pre-2003.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. issue of 4 years, how does that compare with, say, federal law? Is it the same, or is it... What is federal law? Do you know?
I'm sorry, Senator Stevens, the chair. Perhaps Chris could answer that question. I didn't do research of a comparison, just went back to the previous statutory language.
Chris, Liesl here, are you online, and could you answer the question from Senator Stevens regarding federal statute of limitations?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I don't know the exact number of years, but I will tell you that on the FECs, when they investigate, there's been instances where they were going back like 10 years for presidential campaigns. And, of course, you're looking at a lot larger pool than what APOC does. So I really would hesitate to answer that question. I just know that some of the cases that have come to fruition and that I've seen publicized have been quite old.
Okay. We do have Brenda Page with the Department of Law online. Any chance, Brenda, that you know the answer to the question regarding the number of years for the federal level statute of limitations?
Madam Chair, this is Brenda Page, and no, I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
Okay, and any chance Alphaeus Bullard from Legal Services knows?
Through the chair, no, I do not.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Well, from what Chris said, anecdotally, it's obviously a lot longer than 4 years if she knows of cases that go back 10.
Yeah. Okay, further questions for the bill's sponsor? Senator Green.
I just have one on the I wonder if anyone has any information on the difficulty with the difference in the 1 year and the 4 years going back in maybe building up the case either way, or is there lost information, or is there any possibility that you could have not be able to substantiate why something was done after that length of time, or why something was done? I have no idea. I was just curious if the 4 years presents any barriers or any difficulties.
Senator Hill.
Madam Chairman, to answer the question, I would think that there would be, certainly going back and recreating a trail, a paper trail that happened, would be more problematic with the more time that has elapsed. I think that is what drives part of the fiscal note. The APOC has a realization that to do that work, there's going to be a cost. So whether that came into the discussion 5 years ago or not, on the lack of any criticism from APOC on that particular component of the bill that passed or not, I'm not sure. But we can see here in their new requested fiscal notes that there's going to be a cost to doing that. And so,
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, I think not many of us write a lot of checks anymore, but I think the rule of thumb when we wrote a lot of checks was you kept your canceled checks for 7 years. And this may mean that when people no longer serve, they don't clean out their files totally for 4 years.
Madam Chairman, my wife keeps asking me what those dusty cardboard boxes are in the garage.
Yeah.
I've got mine going back forever.
Yeah, and having been the subject of an APOC violation that was based on something that occurred in 2003, it is difficult, I will tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
It's tremendously burdensome. It took, days and days and days and days to try to go back and track down and retrace. So we should just understand that when we make the policy, that it is a burden that you're placing. We're setting it, putting forward so the expectations are there, but there are burdens that come with it. And it isn't just the financial part of, there are lots of things we're required to report now with APOC. Grayson got his permanent fund dividend, his college fund reported this year. There's all kinds of things. So you have to keep records of all that stuff. So mm-hmm. just so we're clear. Senator Bundy.
Yeah. I know in part this 4 year statute of limitation is kind of part of a firestorm public opinion concerned about lack of ethical behavior. But Chris, are you aware of violations that occurred outside the 1 year statute of limitations that you weren't able to address because the statute of limitations had run out?
Through the chair, yes. There's and some of them may have just been minor violations, but yes, there were.
Oh, okay. Well, then it isn't just a PR thing. Thank you.
Okay, further questions for the bill's sponsor? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I don't have anyone signed up to testify. Is there anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 199? Anyone online that I've overlooked? Okay, so that brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. Senator Bundy.
Well, as I said previously, Senator French, I agree with Senator French. The guts of the matter are the four-year statute of limitations. Chris indicated that it is not just a feel-good thing. It is necessary that things do come up that she would have investigated had the statute of limitations been longer. I think this is a necessary move. And if you're ready for a motion.
Okay.
I would move that we move from committee Senate Bill 199 with individual recommendations attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing no objections, Senate Bill number 191 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note has moved out of Senate State Affairs.
I think it's
199. Pardon me, 199. My apologies. Okay. Senator Wilikowski was hoping that I kept that motion there. And so that then brings us to which one? Senate Bill number 203. And Senator Wilikowski. And SCR 12 accompanies it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Good morning.
Staff member Michelle Seideman will be presenting this one.
I'm sorry, 203.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Michelle Seideman, and I serve as staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. With your indulgence, I'd like to begin by briefly discussing SCR 12. SCR 12 would bring Alaska in line with most other states, which prohibit legislators from voting on a bill if they have a substantial financial stake in its outcome. A survey conducted by the National Conference of State Legislatures and published on its website documents that 65% of states ban legislators from voting when they have a significant financial conflict of interest. States in this category include Colorado, Florida, Hawaii, Maine, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming, to name a few. An additional 35% allow legislators with substantial conflicts to request permission to abstain. Most of the states in this category, such as Idaho and New Mexico, permit abstention if a majority of legislators votes to grant it. Alaska appears to be the only state in the nation that requires unanimous consent before a legislator with a substantial conflict can abstain from a particular vote. Peggy Kearns with the Center for Ethics in Government knows of no other state that requires unanimous consent. Indeed, the House Clerk and Senate Secretary do not recall a single time when permission to abstain was granted. In this regard, Alaska is at the far end of the spectrum, even among states with small citizen legislatures. Alaska's existing statutes go to lengths to ensure that conflicts are substantial before a legislator would be required to abstain from voting. Any benefit a legislator might receive from supporting a particular piece of legislation would have to be greater than the benefit a large group of Alaskans would receive in order to require abstention. For example, a legislator who teaches during the interim would not be prohibited from voting on a bill that would raise the salary of all teachers because the benefits he or she would receive would be no greater than that received by all teachers. Alaska's statutes recognize the responsibility of legislators to vote, except in clear cases where their judgment may be clouded by substantial personal financial gain that is peculiar to them. This resolution would require legislators in that position to declare their conflict, identify the specific provision of the Legislative Ethics Act that would be violated by their voting, and then abstain from voting. Requests to abstain due to other than ethical concerns would still require the unanimous consent of the body. We anticipate that there would be relatively few instances in which a member could demonstrate direct and substantial economic benefit that is greater than that received by, again, the substantial class of persons to which that legislator belongs as a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region. This is the existing language of AS 2460-030G. In those rare instances, this change in the uniform rules would provide assurance that decisions made by the legislature are made in the public interest. It would also protect individual legislators from allegations that their vote was influenced by personal considerations. We would appreciate your support for SCR 12.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. a larger substantial number. That's kind of a squishy for me. If I got people chasing me, it wouldn't take many people to be a large number. But if I've got people on my side, I'd probably want lots of people to constitute large. So can you give us a better definition than large or substantial?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, this is terminology used across the country, a substantial class of persons, just to ensure that you aren't all prohibited from voting on a permanent fund because all Alaskans receive it. And I looked state after state to find a state with a good definition of what constitutes a substantial class of persons, and I could not find one. I believe this is left in most stations to the discretion of the ethics committees. And it's the existing language in our statute right now.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Now,
you mentioned teachers would not. That they would be a substantial group because we have lots of them. Fishermen or crab fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Hair crab fishermen. I mean, we're starting, when does it no longer become substantial?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I've had these same discussions with Peggy Kearns and others across the country, and I haven't gotten a clear answer. I continue to get the answer that those decisions have to be made on a case-by-case basis by those bodies within each state that understand the context in those particular states.
Madam Chair, I applaud the goal. I'm just a little concerned that we don't have a good mechanism to getting there.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to fit all this together in my head now. So we have there's a conflict of interest when it comes to voting on the floor. There are also conflicts of interest that we may have in our life where we're precluded from doing certain things because we are a legislator. Now, that's not the same thing, though, right? And let me give you an example just so you know where I'm getting at. When I retired from the university, taught for 25 years, they kept saying for some odd reason, we'd sure like to have you come back and do an Alaska history class, and I found lots of reasons not to do it. And finally, the reason I could really hang my head on was I asked the attorneys, the legislative attorneys, can I teach a class for the university, and they said no. I still have the letter saying it's a conflict of interest because, in fact, you vote on the university budget.
Mm-hmm.
They said the only thing I could do was to teach without remuneration, which didn't interest me at all that initially. but what's the connection between a conflict of interest in voting and a conflict of interest in other areas of our life? Do you see where I'm going with that? And maybe you can help me understand it.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I believe those are separate parts of state statutes. We do have Dan Wayne on the line from Ledge Legal, and he might be able to address that question.
Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Could you answer that?
My recollection is there's a specific statute that prohibits a legislator from taking certain kinds of jobs. It's not just because they might be voting on something that's in connection with it. I think it was aimed more at exerting influence to get a job being a concern or being hired because of who you are. Because of your legislative status.
Are you speaking to something specific, Dan, or are you just waxing philosophic this morning?
I don't have the statute in front of me. I was starting to look it up when...
Okay, why don't you go ahead and look it up and then let us know when you have the facts.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Good, Senator Bundy.
Actually, playing a lawyer on TV here, I think I have it because I had the same experience as Senator Stevens, told very clearly by both the Department of Law here and the university attorneys, the Constitution says you cannot have two positions of profit with the state.
Oh, with the state.
And that's my inquiry, and you're probably getting more information you need to know, was how come a public school teacher still teach and be in the legislature? Well, they're not directly funded by the, they're not directly a facet of the state where the university is. And so that was that. He said, take it to court, go ahead, enjoy yourself. You lose. Though I have to admit that there was a legislator from Juneau here who taught at University Southeast for years, and no one just ever bothered to challenge it. So it could happen, but it's not legal.
Huh. And Fairbanks.
Interesting.
While we're telling personal stories,
I
thought about looking for work in the off season as a prosecutor. That's what I know how to do, and I could do that for the municipality of Anchorage if I chose to do so, but could not for the state for the same reasons. One's a direct sort of subsidiary or arm, and one is not.
Senator Stevens.
So to cross the T here, what you're saying is that these are different animals. One is a conflict of interest in voting on the floor, another is a conflict of interest that we have
constitutionally
in life. Yeah.
And so is there in the other states, and I know Peggy well, and have had her speak at various CSG things. What would be helpful for us as we find our way through this? I think, by the way, lots of lawmakers have been, you know, we've been talking about this for a few years, how to handle it, and it always feels awkward, and you don't really know what to do. And what would be helpful is to get an example of how a few states do handle it. And I think in a small state like ours, the concern that people keep coming back to is that citizen legislature, our families all know each other. It's a very, very small community, and you know, would you end up in a situation where, you know, large numbers of people are conflicted out on a regular basis and public policy is impacted because of that? So, Senator Stevens in French?
It raises a couple issues. One is that legislators, being the weasels they are, they often don't want to take a position on an issue that may be of enormous conflict back home, and would just soon not vote because half the public in their hometown loves the bill and half the public hates the bill, and so it might be convenient not to vote. So that's one of the hard things that we've always had to deal with here, is that you don't have a choice. Of whether you're going to vote or not, you have to vote. You have to make the decision. You have to make the best decision you possibly can, and you make that decision. I guess I'm just questioning the whole issue of how the legislature operates when you've got people that can weasel out on the vote. You know, when you've got issues before you, say we had a different majority in the legislature than we have today. Say we had 11 members in the majority and 9 in the minority. Then it's problematic that you could ever get anything done if people are bailing out because they don't want to vote on an issue. So I think it creates some problems in the managing of just the managing of the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Senator French.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for the bill sponsor along those lines. Does the if we adopted this bill, would it change the tally of votes necessary to pass a bill or pass an amendment?
Mm. That's a good point.
Senator French, through the chair, my understanding is that those requirements are enshrined in the Constitution, and therefore this change in the uniform rules would not change the number of votes required to pass a bill.
And thank you. And if I could follow up, Senator Stevens makes a good point. I wonder what your view of that is. Say it is a difficult issue. Say it's a phone war. And I just assume not, you know, if I could avoid, you know, casting a vote for one side of the phone war or the other, I'd love to do that and say I stand up and declare I have a conflict of interest when 19 other senators look at me and say, that's baloney. You're just trying to walk out on a tough vote. Is there some counterforce? Is there some sort of appeal process? What happens if I declare sort of a non-conflict?
Senator French, through the chair, that's an interesting and important question. There are a couple answers to your question. One is that, and it would be good to have Dan Wayne address this, but a case could be made that someone could complain to the Select Committee on Ethics that somebody is coming up with trumped up reasons not to vote, and the Ethics Committee could carry on an investigation. So we need to hear from Dan Wayne on that question. Another potential answer to your question is that there could be a mechanism put in place by which the body would determine whether your oral presentation about your conflict was amounted to a substantial conflict. So there are probably 4 or 5 bills in the House of Representatives that try different mechanisms for ensuring that conflicts are indeed direct and substantial. Those could include rulings by the presiding officer, a majority vote of the body or even a two-thirds vote of the body. And I would note that previously in Alaska history, your uniform rules did at one time call for a majority vote to determine whether a member did have a substantial conflict. Later on, it was changed to a two-thirds vote, and now we're at the unanimous consent requirement.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. So I think you answered one of my questions. If this bill were become law and I declare a conflict, then whether I had one or not and was prohibited from voting would be a matter of majority vote in a body.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, that is not the intent of this bill. There are other bills that do take that approach. This bill relies on the judgment of the individual so that no other members of the body are put in the position of having to judge whether that conflict is substantial enough. This bill leaves that completely up to the determination of individual legislators. There were people that thought that you could get into all sorts of political maneuvering if one member were to be judged by a majority or the like. So this bill just says, no, you must state the nature of your conflict. You must cite the specific provision of the ethics code. You must go on record, and then you make that determination. And again, the ethics committee is there if there is abuse of that.
Yeah, if I might, Madam Chair, I'm sorry I misunderstood the bill because, it's going to make in the Senate great opportunity for political maneuvering and then create a 20-person ethics committee. Mm-hmm. Now, but I see the plan of your bill, though, opens a huge opportunity for...
Why are you pointing at me?
what Senator Stevens' concern was expressed is, I'll dummy up some idea so I don't have to, a legislator may dummy up an excuse. I don't have to vote because it's a tough vote. I have a personal friend who I think lost an election because he stood up and took the tough vote, and he could have ducked it. And I'd just love to see the complaint go to the Ethics Committee and say that the only thing they could do is say he's crazy that he thinks this is an ethical consideration. All right, how can they consider me unethical if in my judgment I think this has some potential financial impact? I don't see ethics going to have any impact on that whatsoever because they just are not, I suppose maybe they hook you up to a polygraph, but other than that.
Could we do that just as a matter of course for you?
We can judge him unethical, I think. We just
hook him up to a polygraph.
Hey, I believe everything
absolutely.
I say.
Absolutely.
It's just you people that are a little confused.
Senator Stevens, then Green.
Well, it's such a problem, and we've heard so many different options. I mean, some of the options are sending it to the Rules Committee, let the Rules Committee decide, send it to the Legislative Council, let them decide, But the problem with all of those is that it just throws sand in the wheels and drags things down, and it would take us forever to make a decision if people, and people might take advantage of it, we'll slow this down by, I'll have an ethical issue and then it goes to another committee. So, I think what I've heard on the other side is this argument in the House. It's gone on for some time on all of these bills. And the comments by some people is, there's lots of opportunities out there, but, in the end, what we have right now is not as bad as some of the other options that we may go to. So I'm not sure that any of these are better solutions than the process we currently have.
Senator Green and then Bundy.
If Bundy's on that issue,
okay, go ahead.
It's related to that. As a bill's proposed, a legislator would stand up and say, I have a conflict, and here's good reason that I choose not to vote. Have you given any thought to what if this legislator next to you stands up and says, I don't want him to vote, and these are the reasons why they shouldn't?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, that is the very reason why we made the decision to leave it up to the members' own determination. We didn't want other members pointing fingers and saying so-and-so shouldn't vote. We didn't think that would lead to productive dialogue within the legislature.
Senator Green.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. And how many other instances has the legislature amended the uniform rules and statute?
This would, Senator Green, through the chair, my understanding is that this would not amend the uniform rules through statute, but through a, I guess it's a concurrent resolution. So, and I don't know how often that's done. All I know is how many times this particular rule has been amended by the legislature, and that's two times.
Was that by the adoption of new uniform rules or by direction in statute or a resolution?
My understanding was, Senator Green through the chair, my understanding was that it was done in a joint session of the legislature, and I can't speak to, I do have something in this packet that I can look up and answer that question in just a moment. I think I've got it in here, but I can't answer your question fully without taking a look at that document.
Because I know that certainly in the first few years I was here, the uniform rules and the adoption of Mason's current manual were really, really big issues in this body. I've not heard the conversation as much more recently, but the uniform rules is a pretty considered a very powerful piece that the legislature has to keep the legislature in charge of its business. The court has recognized that. And I'm very nervous under this circumstance to doing anything that amends that without the adoption of new uniform rules, a whole new set of uniform rules.
Well, and on that point, what I think we'll do is set this bill aside, but Senator Wilikowski, I think it's a really good bill to bring the discussion forward because it's something that members have been struggling with since I've been in the building, and not knowing how to handle it, not knowing whether to, you know, quote unquote, take a walk in the hall, how to describe what is a conflict, what isn't, and so one of the things we might consider would be whether we want to look at our uniform rules. I know our local assembly in Anchorage has a mechanism by which they deal with conflicts of interest through their own internal rules. And it is a presentation to the body, a discussion about that, and then a vote. It seems to have worked well. Representative Faircloth is on the other side. Perhaps she could weigh in, and different folks who have dealt with this in other bodies. But I think it's a discussion that needs to continue. Perhaps you could get that information to Senator Green in the meantime, and let's continue the dialogue.
I do have another question.
Senator Green.
Do you have any concrete examples that you could present that say this person would be eligible to be conflicted on a vote? And what would be the parameters? What sort of an example or several examples of people for whom this would apply? And perhaps those would not.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah. And also, I'd ask your opinion of and consideration of the unanimous vote seems to be the crux here. Mm-hmm. And would a three-quarters vote or some other level of vote be the middle ground here? Because I've been tempted sometimes to try if we could get people to not object to see what would happen, but it's never happened that received a clearance not to vote. But if there was some other level of voting other than unanimous, would that cure the problem or come closer without many of the other unintended consequences?
You know, the other thing too on that point is that it's happened in various places and points where members will actually get cut off as they're trying to walk through why it is that they have a legitimate conflict, and they're sort of cut off and maybe that there's an elaborate, you know, an extensive public record for what that documented, that the member recognizes and perceives that there is this conflict and for these following reasons, and so forth. But Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're wrapping up, but I just want to thank the bill sponsor and Ms. Seidemann for coming forward with this. It's a very difficult issue. It's a fascinating issue. There's this sort of, you know, complex, philosophical questions, ethical questions, political questions, tactical questions, all wrapped up in this. I think we all know that something has to happen And so I applaud you for having the courage to come forward and start the discussion. I think Senator Green makes a good point about sort of looking for concrete examples, but I would probably soften that a little bit, because it may be difficult, you know, for someone to come forward and say, oh, yeah, let me show you where a sitting member of this legislature voted on something. You know, that may be a little tough. I would encourage you to also look for examples from other states. Those states are able to make it work. You may be able to go to the Colorado legislature and say, yes, here's an example of a legislator who was barred from voting for clear and obvious reasons. And they also may be able to say, it only happens once every 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow Colorado, Florida, Texas, Wyoming are all able to get their legislative business done with some rule that prevents some voting in some circumstances. I share the same reluctance that the rest of the panel has, I think, with changing our rules, because it seems like it works. On the other hand, I sort of feel like a dinosaur at the same time when I say that. It's like, don't do anything, because it's fine the way it is. And so I think we need to be open to the idea that there are methods out there for dealing with what may be a circumstance which is far more rare than most of us perceive. Mm-hmm. I think most of us perceive it as happening on a daily basis and gumming up the flow of business on the floor, whereas it may only be something that happens once or twice a year. So thank
excellent point. Senator Stevens, and then Senator
Bundy. Well, thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. This is, obviously, we're all struggling with this issue. You know, the public elects us. The public knows where the warts are. When they elected me, they knew I was had
a wart and a weasel in one day. Senator Stevens, I don't feel that way about you. I just need to know.
But I know that they knew I had retired from the university, and if they've watched closely, they've probably seen that I voted for every budget, every bill that ever came along that helped the university. Sorry, Madam Chair, but I certainly have done that. And so they knew they were getting when they elected me. And I think that people have a right to say, listen, I knew where the guy was from, coming from. I elected him, and by God, I want him to vote. I want her to vote on every issue. I don't want my elected representative to be sitting in the hallway when an important vote is taken. Don't we have that right as voters, as constituents, as electors, to demand that we need to be represented? We elected that guy. We knew his faults. We want him to vote.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I agree with Senator French that there are many facets to this debate. I mean, you've just raised a very good point, Senator Stevens, about the expectations of voters that their representative will vote on their behalf. I think this issue is so complex, however, and there's so many different sides to it. One thing the committee might consider is whether it would be worth establishing a small task force to look at this issue from all these different angles and come back with recommendations for the body.
Senator Bundy.
Well, I think Senator Stevens covered both my issues. One, when I first ran for office, one of my opponents sent out a note saying the district should vote for him because one of his opponents, me, was even a university professor. But one thing we haven't talked about, and Senator Stevens alluded to it, is the disenfranchisement of 15, 16, 32,000 citizens who elected a representative, and for whatever reason they are opted out of voting. You've disenfranchised those voters, and that's something we ought not to overlook.
Okay, well, we will set aside SCR 12 and SB 203. Thank you very much for your work. It's apparent that you've done quite a bit.
Senator McGuire, we do have a separate presentation on SB 203, if you are able to hear that.
Okay. How is it any different?
This makes changes to the statute governing conflicts of interest.
Let's set them both aside. Okay. Next is, and it's the same concept. Next is Senate Bill 213. Lucky. Oh, okay. Do we have anyone here? Brief eddies?
He just walked out.
About Senate Bill 213.
Thank you, and thank you for hearing this bill.
We'll let you catch your breath here a second.
Pardon?
You want us to let you catch your breath?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is Senate Bill 213, and Pat Davison, the auditor, and I have a strange and wonderful relationship. She's wonderful and thinks I'm strange. And she doesn't marvel.
Should we vote on that?
No objection.
She and I have had some interesting discussions, and it has to do with the scope of the auditor's authority. If you'll look at the bill before you, on line 14, the first page, it says that the audit has authority to an account look at the books and accounts of all custodians of public funds and all disbursing officers of the state. Now, I've wanted that department to have the authority, if Legislative Budget and Audit directs them, to audit any organization that has public funds. And we've certainly heard over the years that there has been some problems. Pat's understanding of her authority is that she only has clearly now present authority to audit state organizations, not any organizations that the state passes money through to them. So what this little bill does is, you'll see it on the last three lines on the second page, is it makes it clear that she has the authority to audit an organization that receives money from or through the state, including money the state has received from the federal government. So this would allow her organization to audit any function or organization that receives public money through the state's hands. And so I think that's pretty clear and pretty simple, I would hope. And but it is a policy decision, one I think that we should make.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Line 13, page 1, that's current law?
Yes, sir.
And so the differences of opinions arise over what constitutes a custodian of public funds.
Yes. And if I might add, the paragraph 2 doesn't quite go wherever we would want, because it seems to mandate that that be done every 3 years. And I wouldn't want Pat and her organization to have to audit every group that receives money every 3 years. And that's why I think that the new paragraph is necessary.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just trying to think of how this would work in the real world. For example, we have some department of senior citizens state, and they fund the senior citizens organizations around the state, including the one in Kodiak. The one in Kodiak performs its own audit and pays for that out of their own funds. They may not be too opposed to having the state do the audit for them. So what you're suggesting is not only would we audit the state organization, but our auditor would also be auditing the Kodiak senior citizens, which would free them up of having to do their own audits. Is that what would happen in reality?
I would hope not. My goal only is that Pat and Legislative Budget and Audit would have the authority to order an audit at their discretion and for their reasons on any organization that receives money through the state. It wouldn't be anything that they would be required to do, only that they would have the authority to do.
Senator French?
But doesn't the bill say that they shall? Page 1, line 4 says the Legislative Audit Division shall, and then number 11 says perform an audit of an organization that receives money from or through the state.
To me.
How many organizations is that?
Yeah, good catch. I had missed that.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to move an amendment on page 1, line 5, line 4, after the Legislative Audit Division, change shall to may.
I'll object.
Okay.
And I would, too.
I'll object, too.
Okay.
I mean,
goodness sakes.
Well, I mean, don't we want them to keep doing what they've been doing? Wouldn't that suddenly make that whole list permissive?
So, that's right. So how do we, let's see.
and at the end of line 22.
That's right. So pardon me. It would be better reflected, my apologies, page 2, line 23. I don't know how drafting would do that, but the concept would be may.
You put a weasel word in 11, says shall as necessary perform, or shall as...
Directed.
A request, well...
Directed.
What would you put at the end of line 22? You put and may.
Or may.
There you go. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
11.
Right.
Okay.
Perform an audit.
So
something like that.
Let's do it as a conceptual amendment then. Page 2, line 22 or 23, as ledge drafting deems. I think it'd be line 22, either and may or may. I think and may.
And then they might want to come in and just do a whole new paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The,
yep.
Do we have anyone from drafting online? No. Okay, so that's the conceptual amendment, amendment number one. Is there any objection to that? And let drafting look at that. Okay, hearing and seeing none, amendment number one carries. Senator Bundy?
But we are going to hear from Pat.
Yes, we are. She's next up. Okay, any further questions for Senator Dyson? Senator Green?
Well, you know, just kind of, you know, overall position, I think that the legislature is, and I don't know if it's a totally different statute or whatever, but we can't audit, the legislature can't require an audit of a school district. It's part of their process, but if I thought something was going wrong in some school district across the state financially or performance-wise, it's up to that school board or that borough assembly, I believe, to order that audit. So I think we're making a mighty reach here to think that we can go to, you know, nonprofits and funders to that happen to receive state money that they can come under our authority. It's not that I object to it, but I think we very definitely need the legals to vet this because it's... I mean, there's some limitations on who you can audit, even if they're, like our school districts are, you know, primarily funded by, now there are audits in the department that are required, but they aren't necessarily legislative audits.
Yeah, and if I may.
Yes, you know, Senator Dyson.
And Pat and her organization have done some research on other states, and some states have it that they, virtually this wording, that they can be a watchdog for the public funds wherever they go, and several of them have it in their statutes that specifically they can audit schools. And I would argue that what do we do if we've got a rogue school district that won't, and we're continuing to pour money into it, then we're abdicating our responsibility to watchdog the public funds that are going through here. And I'm sure a couple of you at this table remember 3 or 4 years ago there was some bits of edges of scandal around in this town about money that was distributed to nonprofits and service organizations out of Health and Human Services, where there was a very cozy relationship between the folks in the administration and the recipients of those grants. And under what I understand of Pat's understanding of her authority, she could only audit Health and Human Services and their process, not how the money was used, you know, and so on. And I want, on the exception case that Ledge Audit says, go do this, our folks to be able to use their considerable skill to see how the public money is being used.
Senator Stevens and then Bundy.
Thank you. My question was answered.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you are giving that example of the ADAC school district where they didn't have any kids for a year and a half, and the superintendent kept getting money and the school board kept hiring him because he kept hiring them. And it was a rather interesting process. I think Department Ed finally shut them down, but there was no audit. But my question is about the federal monies. And did you picture this as federal monies that pass through the state, or they would not be federal earmarks that the federal government gave directly to an entity?
I hope I made that clear here. From or through the state, that's line 23 and 24 on page 2.
including federal monies.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, and arguably, I think the Fed is, rightly or wrongly, trusting us to be stewards of that money that they give to us to distribute it, and we ought to, you know.
Senator Green.
Yeah, and there have been some instances on different subjects where the Feds do audit, and very often they take their cue from us. If we have performed an audit, such as we did one on sewer and wastewater, and that kind of opened up a problem that then the federal government came in, and but they also do audits.
Yeah, we've been looking at some situations around and some past federal audits, and if we are not conforming in several areas, there's going to be some very draconian things that happen, and I certainly would prefer that we catch those ahead of time, you know, before the feds have to come in and do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's have Pat Davidson come up. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you. For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. As Senator Dyson indicated, the ability of legislative audit to go beyond state agencies is currently limited. When an issue came up, I had a discussion with Ledge Legal, and I believe the Senator did too, and we got the same understanding. Legislative audit has very broad but very vague authority. Mm-hmm. What we have, and it's been mostly past practice that has developed this, legislative audit has existed actually since prior to statehood, or a form of legislative audit has. Our ability to go beyond a state agency, it depends upon what sort of grant agreement is written. If a department in its grant says it has the authority to audit, or that this entity receiving this money has to spend the money in accordance with these specific things, we can audit their compliance with that. We sort of stand in the shoes of the department in conducting that audit. However, if you, one, have a poorly written grant agreement that doesn't have address audit-related issues, or secondly, there's another issue outside the specific statutes governing that grant that somebody wants to take a look at. For example, if the Department of Health and Social Services gave money to an entity to build a health facility, and you know, maybe it said, okay, you need to build the health facility, and the Budget and Audit Committee comes and says, well, we want you to go test to make sure that Little Davis-Bacon requirements were met. Unless it's in that grant agreement that they will comply with all those things, I don't really have a basis to go out and audit for that. That's traditionally been our role. As I understand it, not being an attorney, what Senator Dyson's bill is to open up the scope of inquiries that could follow state money or federal money flowing through the state. It would broaden our ability to look at other issues. From not only a financial area, but possibly also a performance area. Senator Green brought up the idea of a school district. If you wanted legislative audit to go in and to evaluate their policies and their procedures, or how well have they been achieving certain goals that they set out for themselves. Under language like this, I believe that would be something that we could do. So it is a policy direction for the legislature to give the audit division.
Excellent. Senator Bundy.
Well, to start with, would you like to have this authority?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, anything that will help the legislature in making its decisions is something that I believe that we should have the authority to do.
Question. Thank you. Having served on budget and audit, sometimes I see audits get requested with personal or political agendas behind them.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And it's not inexpensive. We mentioned the fiscal note before. It's indeterminate. Obviously, no one can know how many of these would come up. But in round numbers, what does it cost to conduct an audit now?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, they run the gamut, probably anywhere from $10,000 to probably over $100,000, depending upon the scope of the audit. We do bill out under federal at a complete billing rate at about $50 an hour for the division. You have CPA, licensed professionals doing the work for you. The conversation with Senator Dyson about whether or not you want that section to be able to be done at my direction as legislative auditor, or you want to invest that authority only in the Budget and Audit Committee to authorize that, I think is an important distinction. Right now, again, sort of historical interpretation of our broad but vague language has been that the legislative auditor, with regard to financial audits of state agencies, while there are statutes that say we have to do certain things, the way that that's written is permissive for us to start a financial-related audit. However, the performance audits, those have to come through a request of the legislative and an approved by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And so really it's the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee that's the gatekeeper for the workload for the division.
If I might.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
If this were to pass, would there be any way that you could put a ballpark fiscal note on each request for an audit? And if they run between 10,000 and 100,000, the committee ought to have an idea, particularly if it appears that the audit is maybe not motivated by completely altruistic ideas, what that audit's going to cost.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, as an auditor, it's financial audits, you know what you're getting into usually. Performance audits, it's almost impossible to tell. You don't know what you're going to get into. You don't know what sort of records are available, what documentation is available, exactly what audit procedures are going to be necessary to gather the evidence to reach a conclusion. I think the discussions at the Budget and Audit Committee have that when an audit request comes up, do ask me, is this a larger audit? Is it a smaller audit? Have you had experience before in this agency? Is this going to go smoothly? So they try to elicit as much information as they can in making those decisions, but it is to some degree a decision of do you want that answer?
Well, Madam Chair, if that question was directed at me, yes. But I could certainly see that the number of audits you're going to do and the staff you need would blossom if the members of that committee were not very thoughtful, extremely thoughtful.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So looking at the custodians of public funds, and I don't know if my example was right, we're talking about we have a senior organization in the state. We also have a senior organization, like in my community in Kodiak, so there's senior citizens there who do perform their own audits. Would you have access to the audits of other organizations? I mean, it seems to me it would be duplication if we audit organizations already auditing itself. Is there a sort of a respect for other audits that would be done, and or would you do another audit of, say, for that organization?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, as it relates to lines 13 and 14 are existing, those have been interpreted as being state agencies. The custodians would be oftentimes in a financial audit, we have to confirm that a bank or a security firm or somebody is holding state assets. And then the dispersing officers of the state indicate those people who are authorized to spend the money. So,
it's sort of line 23 and 24 that really give you the authority to go to organizations beyond the states, for beyond state organizations.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, it is.
And that's really what I was referring to. Would you respect those audits, or would you re-audit organizations outside of the state?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no, we would not. That
would not what?
We would not duplicate any audits, and we would not assume the responsibility for audits of any entity. Actually, that already exists at the state. We are required by law to audit the state's financial statements. However, organizations such as ADA, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Permanent Fund, have long contracted with private CPA firms to do their audits. And so professionally, there is a way for us to rely on the work of others. And so we just coordinate that at the professional overall level.
And that would be then true also of school districts, I assume, who have audits. They perform their own audits, and you would not necessarily have to go in there and re-audit, except maybe in certain programs. If there's a question about, say, how funds are being spent in intensive needs students or something.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I believe that to be true. An example would be we have been asked previously to audit school buses. There's quite a number of statutes that govern how school districts have to deal with the busing. There are statutes, and there is those statutes are referred when the money's given to the school district. So in the past, we've been able to go do those. Repeating financial audits is not something that we would do. What I see this language authorizing us to do is something beyond either in the performance area or to put more attention to something very specific.
Thank you, Pat.
To that point, do you think there's anything that we need to add into the language to reflect what you said regarding duplication?
Through the chair, or Madam Chairman, I think that the issues that you had talked about earlier, first making it permissive rather than the shall. The other thing is whether or not, as a public policy decision, you would like to vest the legislative auditor in being able to initiate those audits, or once we sort of step outside the state, do you, as public policy, want it to be only as directed by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee? And I think once you do that, again, in terms of working with other auditors instead of duplicating it, that is the practice of the profession, and there are ways to deal with that.
I think this is a good idea. I think it keeps everybody on their toes, but I just want to be sure that we address the concerns Senator Stevens had. And then Senator Green brought up some legal concerns as to whether how far you can reach in. And we haven't been able to reach anyone from Department of Law, but those would be good questions to have answered. Senator Bundy?
As our auditor, would you have an opinion as to whether these additional audits that would be allowed by this bill should only be originated in LBNA, or whether our auditor ought to be able to originate them as well?
Madam Chairman, Senator Bundy. I see that as a public policy call, and it would be up to the committee. In past, I would say that I have seen issues come up that I thought were needed, and I approached the chairman of the Budget and Audit Committee and through that process. And so I don't believe that not being able to initiate audits or limiting this new section to not initiating audits would necessarily create any substantial barrier. It could be that that isn't what the chairman wants us to do, and you know, so be it. But again, I think that's one of those decisions for the legislature. Who do they want to vest that authority in?
Well, Madam Chair, and I agree with the goal of the bill. I know when IRS would call me and say, you're going to be subject to an audit, I would find that daunting and intimidating. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little concerned that for political motives, people on LBNA could instigate an audit to intimidate people or just to cause them a ration of trouble. And I suppose the only way we control that is people electing good members. But that is an unintended and a consequence that concerns me, though.
Senator French?
Just a question about whether you have, how much excess capacity you have right now. The fiscal note says that there are 2,000 organizations that receive grants through the state, and I'm just wondering how many of those extra audits do you think you'd be able to perform in a year should we pass this into law?
Is there any way to amend?
Through the chairman, Senator French, when I read the language, I must admit I carried over a thought process that probably needs to be directed, and that is whether or not these requests come through the Budget and Audit Committee. At any given time, we have a certain portion of our audits have statutory deadlines associated with them. Those are what we do in priority. Everything else just gets done as it comes up. And so at various times that delay has been 6 months, sometimes it's up to 18 months before we're going to start an audit. And so it's, again, keeping the Budget and Audit Committee informed. We've chatted various times informally about whether there should be a priority process established. And it's never come to fruition. I don't know how many audits will be generated here. If legislators understand that more than just state agencies can be, then they'll have more requests coming to the Budget and Audit Committee, and then the Budget and Audit Committee is going to have to make
sort
some decisions.
Out. Sure.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anybody else here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 213? Anybody online? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, that brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I appreciate the quality of the discussion here. There may be some additional cost, you know, but that will be at the discretion of the legislature, ledge audit. But if there's fraud going on or bad practice, there's a downside cost to that. Money is being wasted that should be getting to whoever the organization serves, and that too has a cost. We just have a innate responsibility, a first order responsibility to be stewards of the public money, and Pat and her team are our inspectors, you know, to do what they can to make sure that it's been done and good stewardship's happening. So I think there's no downside to this. We can always say, well, we surely can't trust ourselves. We might be misused, but that's like never having a tool to do useful work for fear that somebody might misuse it. Mm-hmm. I actually trust our gang and who will fill these chairs after we're gone. And so I would encourage you to pass this. I had penciled in and thought about on page 2, line 23, after perform, putting in the phrase, when approved by LBNA, to make that clear. That, okay. So it would read, perform, when approved by LBNA, an audit of the organization that receives, and so on. But that's
okay.
Our language, not the drafters, but certainly make clear what I think is a consensus here and certainly what the auditor says.
Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. If you would entertain a conceptual amendment, I think we have two things that we need to address in the bill. Well, one on line 22, page 2, where the words and may or mm-hmm. whatever the drafter would choose, mm-hmm. and then the words that Senator Dyson indicated on line 23, when approved by LBNA, I would move those as conceptual amendments.
And we did, in conceptual amendment number 1, get the and may.
Did we ever pass that?
We did. Oh. And so now we could do an amendment number 2, which would be a conceptual amendment, page 2, line 23, to when LBNA approves.
Yeah. Madam Chair,
Senator Bundy.
When you finish the amendment.
Well, and we can make it conceptual, so however that needs to read to accomplish the goal. Right. Senator Bundy.
While there may be some problems, I think in the main, this is, there's certainly more good to this bill than negatives, and I'm taken with Senator Dyson's tool that, for fear of not having one, because it could be used for ill, you never use it for good. A unintended consequence of this, but a positive one, sometimes folks kind of go to the assignment of the budget and audit committee as an afterthought. And if the duties are going to be expanded and the responsibilities, maybe there will be more forethought in those that choose to serve and those that are allowed to serve on LBNA. Mm. And with that, if you're ready for a motion.
Yes, I am.
Madam Chair, I think we need to make sure everyone approves the amendment that we.
Amendment number 2, my apologies, was there objection to it? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then amendment number 2 is adopted. Senator Bundy.
Yes, I move that we move from committee Senate Bill 213 with attached indeterminate fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection to moving Senate Bill 213 out of this committee? Okay, hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 213 has moved. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Dyson.
And I will commit to go back to Ledge Legal and make sure that they analyze what Senator Green said, that there's nothing else in our statutes that precludes this.
Yeah.
And if there is, we'll deal with it.
Yep.
Thank you.
And I expect that you'll
thank
have
you
that
all.
Dialogue. Okay, thank you. We're